Okay,
let's resume our meeting and we're going to start with the principles of disclosure.
Yes, so we're going to talk about agenda papers 11. We have three papers to discuss today. The first is 11A, which is the due process of permission to ballot paper for the Principles of Disclosure Project. We'll deal with that first. Then we'll move on to the amendments to IS7 and Agenda Paper 11B, which deals with the cash disincentives proposals. And then again, the due 11C, which deals with the due process of permission to ballot for those IS7 amendments for the final standard. So if we start with Agenda Paper 11A, which is dealing with the due process and permission to ballot. And that paper sets out three questions that we want to ask the board. Firstly, the comment period for the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper. We have recommended 120 days, and whether the board agrees with that. Secondly, is the ISB satisfied that we've completed all steps that are necessary to ensure that the Principles of Disclosure DP is likely to meet its purpose, and its purpose is to replace or revise IS1 with guidance that helps entities to determine the basic content and structure of a set of financial statements, in effect to help them use judgment or to enable them to get access to different tools can help them to do that. And then finally, we will ask if you agree that we have permission to prepare a ballot draft for the Principles of Disclosure discussion paper. So if I can start with question one, which is the comment period.
Do we agree with 120 days?
Comment. One question. How many pages do you expect to be included in the discussion paper?
We'd expect it to be about 100, 120.
100, 120 pages.
One day per page.
Good idea.
I'm saying, you know, one.
I have a comment.
Sorry. 120 days for comment period might. Do you think it's reasonable because of the exposure draft conceptual framework? In the case we extended quite a long period, so that's what I'm saying. 120 days.
When we considered this, we were considering whether we should have a longer comment period, for that point, and also that the other issue was that it might be crossing a number of topics. But we felt also that we are having calls externally to move this project forward on a timely basis. And for us, that was more the driving factor to have 120 days to respond to that. We are hoping to issue this discussion paper in Q3, and it's likely it would be March. So that would bring us up to July. End of July, and then if we move in beyond that, you're getting to August, which sometimes is a bit difficult as well. So we did feel that 120 days in this context would be the better option.
Amari?
I think this has become usual. I would argue for more days, and the reason is very simple. I think this is a very important paper. This would be the basis of the whole project. And the whole Latin America, I'm not even mentioning other countries, they do need some time to get into the paper. And the translation of the exposure draft is only available for them at least 2 to 3 weeks after publication. That means, in practice, the whole continent misses 1/3 of the comment period. And I don't think if we extend for 150 days, for instance, we would miss significantly in terms of feedback, in terms of timing provided, to proceed with the project. So I would suggest 150 days.
So Amara, would you make that a general request across two processes?
I depends on the length of the document and the importance of the project. If it's a simple, short document, I don't see any problem. But in this case, considering what she mentioned, and this being the basis of the whole disclosure initiative.
At most documents, I mean, there are some, but most will be at least 100 pages.
Yeah, when this is the case, I've been arguing consistently, and this was the case, for instance, for the conceptual framework, and then, unfortunately, I wasn't heard, and at the end of the day, we decided to extend for another 30 days.
No, we did 150 days the first time there.
No, but I argued for additional 30 days because of this, and the length of the document.
I support.
Can I just ask a question, Amari? There will be no surprises in this paper. So if you follow the project, you will recognise what is in it. Do you think that the sorts of constituents that will reply are the sorts of folks that will already be following the project?
Doesn't matter. That's what the same argument we use in the conceptual framework, that the document was not that different from the discussion paper. At the end of the day, we decided to extend even for jurisdictions that were clearly following the project very close, as Europe was, and IFRAG was one that argued for an additional 30 days. So, and I cannot really assume that everyone is following the project the same level of details that others are. It's my view anyway.
Christy, could you just repeat the timing again that you said before about publication?
We're hoping to get this finalized for March. We haven't guaranteed these things, but you know, we are projecting for March next year. So if 120 days on top of that would bring you to the end of July. So if we extended to 150 days, then we'd be talking to the end of August. In which case, people may argue, you know, in some jurisdictions that August is not an effective month, but
only in Europe and in North America. In Latin America, August is perfect. What doesn't work in what doesn't work in Latin America is January, that we take as a goal. Yeah, in Australia, probably the same.
I mean, selfishly, August is a good month for staff because we don't have board meetings, and therefore it is a good time to be able to analyse comments. But that's an internal, selfish response. But
is it possible to squeeze the drafting period? Because it's not so technically complicated compared to insurance and others.
Well, it is indeed. It's not going to be a very complicated document, I presume. So that would also, be an argument for not such a lengthy.
I think it's what you determine to be complicated. I mean, we're not talking about precise recognition and measurement issues, but actually we're talking some conceptual issues which actually can be quite difficult to work through in terms of thinking. So I don't think, when I say March, we are really pushing to get through the publication process by that time. So I don't think we've got any room to be able to say that we get it before March. And even now, I'm starting to be concerned that might slip slightly.
Well, if that's the case, then I have no strong feelings about 120 or 150 days. I don't think that the world will end. It takes us a little bit longer. It takes a little bit of speed up the whole process. It's not dramatic.
I mean, it's not for a decision today, but the bigger picture. You know, due process handbook says 120 days is normal.
It's the minimum.
Yeah, well, you can go shorter.
No, we can go shorter.
But, you know, should that be 150 days, or, you know, is it the same with every project? Yeah, as you say, bigger documents, but most projects have bigger documents.
The standard norm in the due process is?
120.
Yep.
I think one of the key factors in this is how much discussion do people need to get to their debate. One of the things I've seen is that if you give people new ideas, they need much longer to discuss it, and if you don't give them enough time, you tend to get a fairly undeveloped response, which is what they just first thought of rather than really the result of mature reflection. So I think that's one of the things I would bring into the equation is Are there new ideas? How much do we want people to sort of debate and discuss, or do we think they'll be able to respond reasonably easily?
What's your judgment on this one?
I'm not sure.
Well, that's very helpful. I mean, I think there's two sides of the equation here. It's we need to respond to calls to move more quickly with this project versus calls that people want time to be able to respond adequately and in a considered way. So that's they're the two dynamics that we're dealing with, and I don't know if there's a precise answer to either of them. In our recommendation, we've gone with the responding to people's calls to move the project forward.
But people in the outside world, they see the genesis of this as January 2013 when we did the disclosure call. That is already a long time ago. And I just think if you're interested in this stuff, you should be following it, and we need to move along. Because by the time we get to final amended standards, we're another, I don't know how many years down the track.
Gary? And, I'm sympathetic to what Tomorrow had to say. I think it's an important document, and 50 translations or something, I think, by the time something trickles down. So, Hans, who you are, I don't have a hard feeling one way or the other, but Amaro, I think somebody else who kind of made the point about it, but Wego made a point is it's 5.5 months from now, the end of March. That just seems like an awful lot of time to prepare something. And because we don't have XBRL, we don't have transition requirements, we have discussions of a series of points. Except it's easy for me to say because I've never written one of these things, but I've written a lot of documents in my life. 5 months just comes across. It's a long time. I don't know if we're doing fatal flaw and all those things too. It sort of stays in house, but kind of like Wego was suggesting, is there any way we can shorten the internal time? So you make a good point. Is August is a good month for the staff to do work. And if we need the longer time, we got to find a way to get this thing in from August.
I think when we project out to March, and we've done quite a detailed timing on this, it's not just the drafting that takes the time, it's the time that we need to put it out for the balloting, the pre-balloting, and responding to the... It actually, getting out through to March is a very tight deadline.
Well, like I said, it's easy for me to say that. It just still came across. It's a long period of time.
I think that's the nature of how long it takes to get a due process document.
But before we go, can I just ask another question? Paragraph 7, we moved accounting estimates and presentation of cash flow separately. Can you just refresh us where we are on that, if we're any place? I just don't remember.
The cash flow work?
And the changes of accounting estimates. I just don't remember what we decided and if it's in process or waiting other stuff to get done first.
The changing in accounting estimates is being developed separately, and there'll be another board paper, I think, towards the end of the year, and so that will be brought separately as another paper. The cash flow work has been developed and was always developed by the FRC, and we are still planning to issue a staff paper. We're discussing with the FRC when that may be. It depends a bit on their timeline.
There's just so many moving pieces.
But ultimately, the feedback on that will go through into the primary financial statements project.
Steve? Just on Wegro's and Mauro's comments, I guess it's partly motivated by the whole translation problem and the additional time. And I can understand that effectively there are some constituents which are restricted by 2, 3, 4 weeks, whatever it is, in the time they have to comment. Is there any way of shortening that translation process by providing the translators, the people that are doing this, with some sort of earlier draft and kickstarting the process earlier? I mean, this is not to do with this project, but it just struck me that presumably they get the final thing when everybody else does, and then they beaver away and spend 3 weeks translating.
I'm not sure how it works in detail, because this is much more in the people in the translation. What I do know about this, the translation to, and I'm not even talking about translation to Portuguese, because we don't have it. I'm mentioning translation to Spanish. And the way we, as the foundation, found to balance the various dimensions of various differences in the Spanish world is to create a group of Spanish-speaking representatives from various countries in Latin America, including Spain. And then this group works under the coordination of a Spanish guy. So they have to agree first in their Spanish version and then submit to this final coordinator to bring to the translation and to have printed.
Do we need that for discussion papers, this process?
Well, they are arguing that they do need. We have for exposure drafts already and some discussion papers we have.
Sue?
I just wanted to speak in defense of the staff. I think that, you know, it sounds like there could be a valid case for allowing more time so that people feel they can properly consider the responses, particularly in their native languages. And I can see with discussion papers, maybe you need more time to think about new ideas, but I would caution us against putting our staff under the gun as a way to create extra time for stakeholders.
Well, let's see who can support staff's recommendation.
I wanted to express support for extending the comment period to 150 days. I'm not so much worried about the translation into American as I am I think this project, because it has so many moving parts, and I think that's been a real challenge for the staff to manage, it also means that people don't have a good understanding of it. So when they pick up the DP, that will, I think, be the first time many people wrap their minds around it, and they have to understand what's in there and what the implications for something for the board, something for preparers, you know, how it comes together. So I think allowing people to really have that time, I agree with Sue about not trying to put pressure on moving up the March date if that's, you know, what you think is a challenging target. I'm sorry that you'll lose a good month in August, but I think that in this case, I think we'll make more progress in the end if we have better informed comment. And I think there's going to be a challenge with people understanding what this really means.
Okay, let's first vote on 120 days. Who can
support? Five, I think that was.
And who can support 150 days?
Majority.
I can still support that.
10, is it 10?
Well,
it's 150 anyway. I think it was 10. It was Hans' vote.
Twice.
You don't get a cast
away. Especially
if you split the 50, was it 770
and a half?
Can I move to question two then?
Yes.
To ask whether the ISB is satisfied that we've completed all the steps that are necessary to ensure that the principles of disclosure discussion paper is likely to meet its purpose.
All in favour?
And then question three, do the staff have permission to prepare a paper of the principles of disclosure discussion paper?
All in favour.
So if we move now to agenda paper 11B on cash disincentives, and Eduardo will lead that.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Paper 11B is a comeback from the last board meeting we had in September. So it's about the cash proposals that we included in the IS 7 amendments together with the reconciliation of liabilities. And the issue we discuss here is the disclosure of cash that is available to be used, but that is subject to some form of economic restriction or disincentive. So at the last meeting, the ISB has asked us to present an option for the cash proposals in an attempt to finalize both the amendments in IS 7 together. We present such option in paragraph 19. And in paragraphs 20 to 23, we present our analysis of how we think that this option responds to the concerns that we have heard from preparers, from the board, and while still thinking that it would respond to users' requests. So the first question we ask to the board is if it agrees with the staff analysis in that those paragraphs. But I'll move ahead on the paper. Of paragraph 20 to 23, although we think that such option that we present addresses the concerns that we have heard, we think we would benefit from further testing, field testing of that option before we finalize this part of the amendments. Paragraphs 24 to 28 set out those options and the advantages and disadvantages of each, that we think, and also asks if the board thinks that such further testing is needed. Now, the potential options we have to keep moving ahead are decouple the disincentives from the IS, from the reconciliation, so the reconciliation is finalized alone and we keep working on this, or delay the whole package so we can deliver the whole package together after the testing. As a preliminary and very limited testing, we have reached out to some preparers, which are members of the GPF, before this meeting, and to get some of their views regarding this option in paragraph 19. This preliminary limited feedback indicated similar concerns from the DED stage in regards to some of the analysis that we have in paragraphs 21 to 23, which is an entity can easily avoid those disincentives because of its internal means of moving cash, and it has a lot of ways to do that, and that this disclosure does not approach other types of liquid assets, which we already pose as a problem. Other type of liquid investments, it just touches on cash. The feedback also suggested that the option in paragraph that we have in paragraph 19 may not be reflecting our thinking in paragraph 20D, which is when we try to use in the wording the word subject to, we're trying to pose to the entities that if they have means to avoid the disincentive by any internal means, they don't need to disclose it. And some of the preparers think that such wording is not very clear and they might not get away with it yet. And at last, there is a concern raised by in terms of cautioning if this disclosure requirement was not derived from one jurisdiction only in terms of these tax problems that we have. So our recommendation in paragraph 29 is to further test this option, decoupling this requirement from the reconciliation, and then open for discussion throughout the paper. Do you agree?
I just found the order of questions here is a bit confusing because you've asked us first, do we agree with the changes? Then I was getting concerned about that because it wasn't sure. But then you say, well, we need to do more testing anyway and decouple them. So I don't think we need to answer question one.
Question one is more for open for debate if you think that the reasons why we think it responds are not really correct.
But I would rather have that debate after we've done the testing.
I guess you're trying to work out what to test.
What we told staff last month. I think last month we told the staff we want to see the wording in order to understand the testing. So I think this is a direct response to our request.
It is. I mean,
I don't disagree with that, but I'm just worried about the question. Question number one. Do you agree with the proposed amendment? I'm not sure until the testing has been done whether I agree or not.
If we change that to, do you have any comments on
this?
Okay,
a little bit. So, I understand it from Ian's proposal that actually question number one is not necessary to be explored right now because it's directly asking that if we covered correctly the feedback and our feedback to you, but going straight to question number two, let's say, well, this is our idea, we are going to explore and bring to you in the future. Is that so?
We've got a timing situation because we have the reconciliation for IS7, which the board agreed on last month.
Yeah.
And we want to be able to finalise the standard for that proposal for the end of the year. It means that if we want to do that, we need to agree. And you want to also include with that reconciliation these proposals on the cash restrictions. We need to be able to finalise those cash restriction amendments this month because we will not have time to be able to publish the reconciliation and the cash restrictions proposals if we leave the cash restrictions proposals together, if we want to do it before the end of the year.
But we understand that. But
mm-hmm.
And I agree with your ultimate proposals, but I guess what I'm questioning is whether we need an in-depth debate on question one.
We do if we want to put it in this year.
If we think we should keep them together and finalise for the end of the year, then I think we do need the debate.
So shouldn't we answer that question first?
Okay. We can move to question two first.
I mean, other people mightn't agree, so.
Yeah.
Stephen.
So what testing do you think you need to do on this? You've asked the GPF and they've given you a couple of responses. What else do you think you'll get out of testing?
I think we need to actually expand it, the population of preparers that we ask, because at the moment we've developed this pretty much internally. We've had from last month to this month to develop this, and I think we need to make sure that the wording actually is doing what we think it should do and it's operational. So yeah.
It's the operational bit of it, because we've had a lot of feedback from preparers that this would be, could be very difficult to make operational, and I guess we need more of a feel for that.
Yeah, and maybe it might be just a more detailed feedback with a more, greater number of preparers.
But you identified two things from the GPF. They say, well, there's no disincentive if we can easily avoid. Fine, there is no disincentive, so they don't disclose. And it doesn't apply to other liquid assets. Well, maybe we should expand it, but at least let's get this bit in place pending a longer-term project. I don't see the problem with this that a fatal flaw review couldn't deal with.
Gary? And, how long do you think the testing period would last? Because I would like to get the reconciliation of the debt roll forward out. I mean, if you told me you needed a month, I might say, fine, let's wait. You know, if you said you need 5 months, no, I'd say then we decouple them. But what are you thinking for a time horizon for the further outreach and research?
We were thinking of reaching out to the GPF in a formal meeting in a more extensive way with directed questions in terms of bringing the rewardings and really highlighting the details of the issue. So probably a GPF meeting.
I'd say a month.
We're at the short end.
I think
that
there's this GPF.
But I think going through it, I actually support where we want to go in the disclosures, but if it landed on my desk and try to respond to it, I'd probably be pushing on what's your definition of a disincentive. If it's a 1% toll gate tax, that's not much of a disincentive. If it's 30%, it's a big one. So what are we going to allow it to be an accounting policy disclosure? Here's how I defined disincentive, and you really keep the standard at very principles level. But then you get the question, well, if I have a disincentive to remit, remit cash and pay, record deferred taxes someplace, but what if I've got an unrecognized tax credit carry forward someplace else? You get the degrees of separation. Is it just the immediate direct effect that's the disincentive, but I kind of fund it someplace else, and offsets it? Is that a disincentive? And we talk about tax planning strategies in here. Well, there's operational strategies you can do. If your cash is somewhat blocked, we can move business into it, perhaps, and get to spend the cash that way. So you probably have to address, if you're going to look to business and tax planning strategies, define what is prudent, feasible, and do you say, is it theoretical or is it a realistic strategy? I think these are the questions that I think people are going to be asking on. And I think you need the time to, we can leave it open, let them respond to it, or I think we can try to provide the answers during our outreach, but I think it's going to take time.
But I think to your point, keeping it at a principles level, I don't think we do want to create lots of bright lines about, toll gates and rates of tax and whatever, but that's the reason why it's hard to make operations.
Are you going to leave it to the preparer to define what is a disincentive? In that case, your project's pretty easy.
To a large degree, we're going to have to, because otherwise we're going to have to create lots and lots of detailed rules and bright lines, which I don't think we could do
in a month. Because the
month envisages that we work with the proposals that we have in paragraph 19, and making sure that what we're proposing there is broadly operational. That's the month.
Actually, I think it is operational,
and anything more is a broader project, which I think would have to decouple, and we'd have to take a lot more time to do.
Yeah, so it really truly would be really principles based, and that's okay. And I think the other thing, going back to our definition of your materiality project, if you're going to say, what's the framework of materiality? Is it the amount of trapped cash, or is it the amount of the disincentive? And I think that answer would have to emerge out of here as well. And again, we could leave it to judgment, but if I have a small disincentive on a lot of trapped cash, what's the materiality frame of reference? Again, I think before a standard is issued, that would probably have to be, you know, at least considered.
I see that nearly everybody wants to speak, so let's avoid repetition.
I'm largely in agreement with where Gary is. I've always felt that this project as a whole is a splendid idea. My biggest concern, though, was the way the requirements have been articulated, and will it elicit a comprehensive and really fair presentation of a net debt position? And so on the reconciliation, my big concern deals with the way an entity might treat short-term debt of 90 days or less, if in fact they're applying the definition of financing in IAS 7, because IAS 7 in paragraphs 22 to 24 in a statement of cash flows could effectively net those and they wouldn't be displayed. So for purposes of this reconciliation, I'd like to make an exception to that definition to have a comprehensive view of financing and include all debt, whether it's due overnight or whether it's due, you know, 100 years from now. So that's one of my bigger concerns with the reconciliation. On this disincentives paper, I really think you do need to do more outreach to understand the operational implications of it. You mentioned, Eduardo, the notion of not taking into consideration other marketable securities investments, which, as we've seen in recent, you know, financial press articles, is where most of this type of asset is being parked. It's not sitting in cash or cash equivalents anymore. It's sitting in marketable investments. So if that's going to be excluded, okay, that wouldn't be very helpful. We've also seen recently some illustrations of net debt in companies that are undergoing some financial stress, and some of those reconciliations are quite, I think aggressive in terms of what they're displaying as liquid assets. And so we're just going to, I think, circumscribe a certain portion of what might be displayed in a net debt reconciliation. And then what people might do is going to be up to their decisions, right? It's going to be outside the standards. So I'd rather go more comprehensively and more prescriptively as to what a net debt reconciliation can and cannot include, and the kind of caveats that should go along with it. If that takes another 6 months or whatever, I think we're better off putting out a good product than something that's going to be subject to criticism or question. I appreciate your point earlier about the urgency, but I see that as an artificial deadline. I really do. I think the market wants something that's useful and it's reliable, as opposed to, you know, a check the box. We completed this.
It's just in terms of the feedback that we've had from investors. Mm-hmm. What they really want is their number one want is the some of the non-cash movements that's going to be delivered through the reconciliation. And they've been asking for that for a long period of time. They do think this is useful information about the cash, but they say that they can get that information already from financial statements. So their emphasis is on the reconciliation, and I think that is sort of driving our response to try and make sure that we deliver that. And I think one of our concerns is that if this discussion delays or pushes that too far ahead, then it may, we don't want to jeopardize that going through as a final standard, whether that's this year or next year.
Martin.
Yeah, I really, we should not include that in that, because I think it is not operational, because we're saying are subject to economic incentives to their use, and say, okay, if they would cause cost. And what is it? If I would invest my cash in securities, I have to pay transaction costs. So is that use of cost? Is it a disincentive which I have to, when every kind of use of cash, cash maybe has some costs related to that, if I invest in property, in whatever. So do I have to disclose that then? And also, I think we need more work for that. Mm-hmm. And as you propose, I think we should do more outreach, more maybe better ideas how to really what users want to have regarding this disincentives, whatever that is, and finalize the reconciliation piece of that and That is what I think we should do.
I think I am being persuaded by the discussion here at the table to split out the disclosures about cash. I'd come into this saying, I think we can do this, and I think we should move ahead with it. To me, it's very important that if we are going to do something, that we do it as a package, rather than dribble out one amendment to IS-7 this year, another one next year, because you know, we'll just continue to feed the constant state of change, even if they're relatively focused. So if we're going to do something, I think the things have to be as a package. So that means if we can't get the disclosures about restrictions done to be part of the net debt reconciliation, then we need to put it, find something else that it goes with, rather than pursuing it as an independent cleanup project. And it's not AIP or minor scope amendment kind of thing. I came into this meeting saying, even if it means holding the net debt another 2 or 3 months, then let's do that, because people know it's coming. If they're listening to their investors, they're hearing that their investors want it and they should be providing it voluntarily. And, you know, because they know sooner or later this is going to become a requirement. If the feedback you have heard throughout this project is so universal that it's like, you know, we give 80 out of 100 points, you know, in terms of importance to the reconciliation. Yes, of course, we'd like this information about cash, but it's 15 or 20 points. Then let's just go ahead with the reconciliation. If it's more balanced, then I'd say let's hold it. To me, the argument about short-term investments, I don't worry about that as much. I think it's a nice to have, not a need to have, but I can see some further issues that I'd want to test at least the wording and the operationality about the disclosures. I can provide those offline, but it does make me wonder whether we could actually get it done in a month.
Darryl? just in terms of what you've got in paragraph 19, the actual wording that you're suggesting, I was actually very comfortable with the wording to the points that Gary and Steve raised. I think that the wording largely gets us there at a principle-based level. And my expectation would be if we went through the whole route of trying to see if we could apply more rules, almost certainly we're going to circle back and come back on a principle-based approach, because I don't see that we can actually define precisely what this process is. So I was comfortable with the economic disincentives and the definition that you've given in paragraph 49A. I would also agree with what I think Steve said, is that I think we're unlikely to get a lot of additional information beyond what we've already heard from the GPF through the process. I did find it interesting that the GPF, one part of the GPF response was that this doesn't go far enough, because essentially they have the tool in hand to provide the additional information if they think it's important. And I think it, almost to an extent, they would be required to do it if they feel that they're giving incomplete information. So my starting point when I read this, similar to Mary, was that I actually thought this would work fine, and I thought it was operational, and I didn't think there was an issue if we're comfortable going out at principle level, which I am comfortable going out with. I think it is operational because it is at a principle level. In terms of the size issue that some have raised, I think we have size issues every time we get into these sorts of things. That's materiality, and we're comfortable to leave people to consider materiality in other spaces. All that said, moving on to your second question, my argument would be if we conclude as a board that we need to do further research, then I think we need to give that further research the proper opportunity to play out. So if we do conclude that we want to do further research, then I would rather decouple. Get the net debt out and get that done, and let's take a proper amount of time rather than try to rush through some type of process. I just think once we start doing that outreach, once we start talking to people, ideally, we perhaps go beyond GPF at that point in time, and then I think we need to take as much time as it takes. But back to my previous point, I don't think we need to do it in the first place.
I think if we do outreach, I think even if it's a month, it will push the package beyond the end of the year. So just keep that in mind. I don't necessarily think that's a huge problem, but it would mean that it wouldn't be an end of year ED, even if it was just a month.
But a month sounds very optimistic.
I think if
we are going to ask people to actually contribute to our process, we need to give them a clear indication that we're going to properly consider whatever views we get. And I suggest that means we're going to have to go through the path Gary talked about of considering whether more rules make more sense or less rules and et cetera, et cetera. So my preference would be if we do decide to do it, then let's step back completely from the process, and then we can consider bringing in the additional things like the liquid instruments and et cetera at the same time. Perhaps to Mary's comments so that we don't end up with multiple iterations.
I'm not convinced that the wording proposed in paragraph 19 here is operational. I think Martin made the point about which costs are considered. Any transfer of foreign currency to your local currency as a cost, minor cost, but a cost. We do not talk about significant cost, we talk about any cost. It's not very precise. So it means every cash is restricted. Maybe not. It doesn't make sense. So I think we need to be more operational. The idea that the entity determines that balances will not be distributed in the foreseeable future, does that mean that those balances are not available? Is it only based on management intention? I'm not sure it is very operational. I think it requires more testing and more analysis before we can go out with this project. Regarding the point made by Mary, I think I would also, unless there is a compelling evidence, I will not decouple the two paths, the two legs of the project. I like the idea of a stable platform. I don't like the idea of making the standards move every year if we can avoid it. So unless there is compelling evidence of a very urgent matter to be dealt with immediately without having completed the walls, I think I would say let's keep the two things coupled and let's do it as a package.
Could I just react a little bit on the cost point? Because I think what we probably ought to do is find some words to indicate that we're not talking about, you know, the normal kind of costs that are involved in doing foreign exchange transactions or buying securities. They're not those sorts of normal costs. They're over and above that. And I don't know what the word is, but
I think there is an issue here. We need to have a look at this drafting and maybe test it a little bit with.
I had a suggestion on drafting because I'm not sure you've written what you mean, and it sort of relates to what Martin and Philippe have been saying, because when I go to buy a drink, the cost of champagne causes a disincentive, but it doesn't stop me drinking champagne, right? I think you're missing cause and effect. So I think it needs to be an economic disincentive to their use that means that in effect it's not available for use. So you need a cost that is such that it causes a disincentive that means it's not available. So what you're trying to do is expand this concept of not available to say it's not just because it's legally unavailable, it's there's something economic going on that causes it to be unavailable. And I think you're just missing the cause and effect. So I wouldn't change it from being a principle, but I think you're missing the consequence of the economic disincentive. Because read literally, I would agree that there's a cost of transferring funds internationally, a bank charge. 49A says that's an economic disincentive, so I have to disclose that. I don't think that's what you mean.
Because we could sort of amend 49A and say something along the lines, I don't know if we want to use a size terminology, but the magnitude of the cost is such that it causes the disincentive. Yeah. It's something along those
lines. Well, it means it's not available for use because of the economic disincentive.
Oh, exactly.
You just need to cause an effect in there. It's missing at the moment. But I think you would need to then do it. I think it's probably, as Steve says, more of a extended fatal flaw. What do you think is going to be captured given the words we're using? I don't think it's, you know, a great big huge exercise, but just to make sure people and what I'd be looking at is not so much operationality, it's what do you think you would disclose as a result of what we've written down here to make sure we're capturing the population we're aiming for.
I think the decision on whether we should decouple or not depend on the assessment whether we can, you know, finish the testing or further work within around three months. I don't think it is possible. Therefore, I support decouple.
Mary?
Just a bit further to Sue's point in terms of what do we think we're trying to ask for. One thing that came to mind today is, I think this is still principles, not rules and detailed bright lines, but I think if there is a disincentive that means that the funds are not available, that we want the disclosure of that existing and management to discuss then what they could do to mitigate or manage that, as opposed to only getting disclosure when the company concludes that there is no way that they could avoid that, you know, incurring those costs, and therefore that it is actually trapped. And at the risk of causing this whole project to hit a brick wall, I mean, because I want this disclosure. I think it has the right scope, and I think what the staff has brought as a draft shows that it can be done, even if it needs some testing. Is it reminds me of the debate that we got into with going concern, and whether you want disclosure of the fact that there is a concern and how management plans to mitigate that, versus only getting disclosure when management finally puts up its hands and says, there's nothing I can do that will eliminate this uncertainty, which is where we are today. And I don't want to repeat that here with only getting the very tip of the iceberg when we say there is nothing you can do. And so I think bringing out this notion, although subject to what Sue said, about it's not any disincentive, any cost that is a potential disincentive, it's a disincentive that rises to the level that it restricts the availability. So I think there's hard drafting work rather than easy drafting work.
Yeah, I guess I'm confused about what's not available for use by the group, which is set out a bit more in 49 and 49A. But the example we had at this table was a pharmaceutical company that's got money in Venezuela. But I'm very much at Martin and Gary and Philippe's camp. I mean, Gary said you can move, so that money that's there can be used to pay wages in Venezuela or do this or that or the other. Does that mean it's not available to the group? Because then in 49 we come down, it's not available to other subsidiaries or the parent, which is kind of a different point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just don't know how you fit all that together.
In the part of 49 or 48 that you're talking about is already there, isn't it? It's not part of this change.
Yeah, I know, but I still don't know what it means. I don't know if anybody reports under
that's,
that.
That's a whole new
that's
issue.
The problem.
Yeah, but then we're changing it by adding 49B and 49 big A. That start talking about the parent and other subsidiaries, and so setting aside that subsidiary in Venezuela, and the fact that you can use that money in Venezuela would then be ignored because you can't take it out and give it to other subsidiaries or the parent. And I'm just not sure that's all the right principle.
May I
just? Yes,
I was in and out on the commentary because I was puzzled with the notion of we are talking about only costs, and paragraph 48 goes beyond that. And I'm in the same position as Ian and Martin on that, in terms of I think it's not really clear. We are not capturing what we want here in completeness. And as for the disclosure in paragraph 48, I did a research in some Brazilian companies that are operating in Latin America. And there most of them, they do disclose the potential of accessing cash, particularly in countries like Venezuela. So, Steve, there is at least one company, one of the largest companies, it's an airline company in Brazil that has interest in some countries that have limitations on transferring cash. They do disclose, and they make a note on that. So. And finally, just to reinforce all that, I think Philippe touched a very important point. If there is not an urgent need for us to decouple it, I wouldn't do that because of the effort needed to make regular adjustments to standards. So, if necessary, and I think it's necessary to arrive at a better translation of what we do have in mind in terms of wording to be operational, in my view, we can do all together.
The problem is that people take quite a legal interpretation of not available for use, and it's physically cannot access it. My question is, if we do decouple, when is there any prospect of doing this change? It seems to me that we either do it now or it's a long way in the future.
I think it could be.
I
would also think if we did decouple that we would expand it beyond cash and cash equivalents. I would hope that we would, and we would bring in the notion of marketable securities, because I think a lot of those funds that do sit overseas are invested in marketable, highly liquid marketable securities rather than cash, in which case I'd start to think whether IS7 is the right home for this disclosure. I think the staff proposal all the way along has been to decouple, let's expand this, let's make this a different sort of broader project rather than attaching it to the reconciliation, which isn't what the demand that necessarily we've had from users. And I think decoupling gives us the chance to make that broader project. Now, the timing, I understand your point, but I...
But realistically, this isn't going to change until IS7 itself changes and we have a new presentation standard, a new cash flow standard. And that's down the road with the primary financial statements project.
I think it could be incorporated into IS1 changes that we are, I mean, what the principles of disclosure might include ultimately reworking IS1.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in some ways this is it relates very much to IS7, but I think it also fits in with some of the general disclosure requirements in IS1 about restrictions and other kind of context points that you need for the financial statement. So that's the only other thing I can think of in terms of where it might sit, is whether it could be picked up in something on IS1.
But that one we just voted. So should we add this piece into it?
No, we haven't voted.
No, DP.
Yep, the discussion.
Yeah, I wasn't saying put it in the DP, but I'm saying if we're changing IS1 as a result of the discussion paper, then this could be added onto that.
What did we vote on last month on this project?
Last month we voted that we agreed with the proposed amendments. Now correct me if I'm wrong, Arjuna. We voted that on the proposed amendments regarding the reconciliation, and that should proceed
irrespective of this, right?
Irrespective of this, and but could you go back and give it one more go to see if you could create a proposal which we could combine with the reconciliation to bring it forward as a package?
I'm not sure if we're playing by our own rules here.
Gary? Christy, I came in here as sort of undecided whether we should decouple or not, but having listened to this discussion, I think it should be decoupled. And I think this is going to take longer to do than you think. I think I had forgotten the point about a lot of this trapped cash in different countries might be in marketable securities, and I think that's, we miss a lot by if you keep that out. I mean, I could see a quick way to doing it and say that a principal's disclosure would be, in tabular form, you list which countries or major cash equivalents and marketable securities are based. Another column, discuss the difficulties with getting that cash out of the country to the parent. You could do that. But you have to say it's in your policy note, describe how you determine what a disincentive is or barriers to removing. It could be done. But I think to be done right, I think we need a little bit more time than we're giving. I personally like the debt roll forward. I think we should get that finalized now, because I think this is only dealing with one line on the balance sheet, cash, even though granted might be marketable securities and cash equivalents, but essentially one section of the balance sheet. I'm not bothered by having a multiple changes to IAS 7, one for the debt reconciliation and one for this, because they're essentially unrelated in terms of how you approach the disclosures and getting it ready.
I
So it should be first vote on whether you want to see this decoupled or not.
That's right.
So who would be in favour of decoupling?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in favour.
Decouple. So then we don't need to discuss the amendment further. We could actually move to agenda paper.
So it's another question in the paper that just to clarify with you in paragraph 33, we have received a lot of feedback in terms of what we already even discussing here in the board as well about this broader broader project on liquidity and to look at things together comprehensively, and now that the decision has been to decouple it, is a decision for us to do with this discussion of this type of disclosure on the cash disincentives is going to go in this project on liquidity or not, and etc. But the question we would like to ask you is that if does the ISB think we should look at liquidity as a comprehensive project and still to decide given the agenda consultation and etc. that's still to come. As paragraph 33.
Martin? I clearly think we have to do that because I'm against this disclosure because for me it does not make any sense. Because we have group financial statements, but based on how the liquidity is managed on a group, central, decentralized, I think all plays into part here. And if we have then piecemeal disclosure, also with this cash. And if the cash is sitting in a location, but also the liability is sitting in the same location, what is the issue? But then to require if they have restrictions to move cash. But if there is not any need to move cash because the liability is in the same location, why should we have this disclosure? And therefore, I think we need to have really meaningful disclosure about liquidity, a more comprehensive view of that. Otherwise, it is piecemeal stuff, and I think will not give really good information about the liquidity situation of a company, and especially if we're dealing with groups, with consolidated companies. And that is, I think, I really agree to your question, the last question, okay, really, we should include it in a bigger project which looks at liquidity, better liquidity disclosure overall and not this piecemeal stuff.
Maybe.
I think that this disclosure about disincentives is one we should try and carry forward. I think it does not need to be in the principles of disclosure discussion paper, but if, you know, assuming we then develop an exposure draft out of that amends some of the basic financial statement standards, I would hope that we could incorporate whatever evolves out of this. So in essence, the discussion that we've had is the equivalent of a DP because it's a much more focused issue, and join those two streams, okay, rather than kind of parking it. I'm not opposed to doing something on liquidity, but I'm a bit worried about adding something that could be quite a significant project kind of on the fly,
yeah,
especially when we have an agenda consultation running. If the staff thinks that further work on liquidity is appropriate in terms of the principles of disclosure project, I'm not sure how we'd work that in. But so what I'd like to say is I'm not opposed to doing it, but I don't think we've done the right kind of consultation on how big a project it is, what would be involved, where would it fit, etc., to decide right now, although it seems like a good thing to do. I do think that this is something that should live on independently of a decision on liquidity. If we decided we were doing liquidity, then I see it fitting in. If we decide we're not, I think we should not automatically drop making this disclosure, but we should do further work to see how it can be made useful.
I split this suggestion into two parts. One is whether we should expand into liquidity. I will support, you know, Martin's idea. But on the other hand, I'm not very clear about the relationship with agenda consultation. It's because, as I understand, we didn't discuss clearly these aspects in the agenda consultation. Then My sense is we have to wait for a loud call for a disclosure type of project on this particular aspects, all right? If let's assume people all are very silent on this, then we will do nothing, all right?
Yeah, so paragraph 33 mainly, this discussion on liquidity comes from the feedback we received in this project. So this project, when was discussing this incentives disclosure, said we think we need many respondents, preparers, standard setters, they said we think we need a bigger project on liquidity to deal with liquidity disclosures, including this. Maybe don't do it now, is sort of what Martin explained. So that's the feedback we have received through this project. So I guess we might want to see if that feeds in together with what we hear in the agenda consultation as well, if something comes up, right?
So based on what you said, you know, let's assume if there is no clear call, then we should discuss board among board members separately, as
yes.
The Mary suggested. We just, you know, keep going, you know, on the current basis. If there's strong call, we may have a separate project on this, or either into more broad, you know, disclosure principles or the financial statement presentation project. Am I right?
Gary?
It, you know, at one level, I certainly support a liquidity project. I do think it has to be subservient to the agenda consultation conclusions first. But several years ago, the FASB had a project on this. I was on one of the working groups a few times, and it, as you can see, they don't have a standard on liquidity. And I don't know if you followed that or did some research, but my experience having supported that project, one is it grew, it got bigger and bigger, and from what you originally thought you might be able to do it comprehensively, and I would just say it didn't end very pretty. But I think there's some history that you perhaps could tap into, you know, for how that project went.
Mary?
Just a follow-up in terms of process. My suggestion, Eduardo, if we've heard a lot in, you know, coming out of this project, that there's an interest in liquidity, rather than asking us to decide today whether or not we want to add a project, I think I would ask the staff to go away and, you know, and come back with a proposal that we can consider, maybe even as we start getting feedback from the agenda consultation. I'd like to make clear that I think the board can be proactive rather than we can only undertake standard setting in response to feedback that X needs to be done. We can identify that we think there's something that needs to be done and make that decision. So I don't want to be entirely subservient to the, you know, the agenda consult, but I think it would make sense to ask us to make a decision when we have an outline of what the scope and work effort would be. And it might make sense in terms of timing to start thinking about that as we also have the context of the other feedback from the agenda consult.
So basically a discussion on the scope of this potential project after we do some more research and listen to some more feedback.
Well, I think take on board what we've heard in this project, see what the agenda consultation brings back, and then bring a paper to the board. See what the FASB did, and then bring something back to the board.
But is that, Christy, is that in lieu of, is that a replacement for the disincentive discussion or separate?
It would incorporate it, so it's a, so I don't know if you call it that a replacement, but I would.
But I'm saying, but this is going to take time, you know, when.
So as just to reformulate it, can we support our staff's recommendation?
Well, we want to ask whether we can support what Mary suggested, which
yeah.
I think sense that people agree with that. It's more Mary's suggestion.
Mary's suggestion, so that taking on board the responses that we had in this project, what we hear back in the agenda consultation, looking into the what the FASB did, we would, after we've done that, so it would be after the agenda consultation comes back, we would bring a paper to the board which would set out the scope and the work effort needed to project. Make a decision at that
make
point.
An assessment in the round.
So it could be back to being as narrow as
your paragraph.
One of the things we did here was we'd ask about cash and users were quite forthright in giving us a lot of other disclosures they would like, so that would be included in the proposal.
Could
Yeah, and it might be you should peel off this project and do it separately and find a home for it, or it might be you should do a broader.
Can we agree with this?
So then we'd move to agenda paper 11C, which I'll pass over to Arjun.
Thanks for speaking. So the agenda paper 11C summarizes the due process steps and asks for permission to ballot the final amendments to IS-7, and since the board decided to decouple, we can swiftly move into Appendix A and the related material. Since it's the final amendment, if the board agrees, we can directly go to the questions listed in page number 7, and we'll go through each question and take on board the comments. The first question was on the re-exposure. Does the ISB agree with staff recommendations not to re-expose the amendment?
Was he reading it?
That was not in favour. Permission to ballot?
Permission to
ballot. And TAC wants to make a comment?
Yes.
Okay. And the third question will be on dissent, so.
Oh no.
Yeah. And the two and three together.
Oh.
Right. I'm going to dissent this proposal, and I have three reasons. And the first reason
only
is
only three this time.
Yes, improved.
Oh. Right.
Actually, you know, it provides only incomplete information, and it cannot satisfy the needs of the users. I do appreciate the effort you made. However, I don't think it would provide good information to the users. This is because I don't think the information given by the cash flow statement itself is incomplete. So linking to the cash flow statement is a wrong idea. We shouldn't do that. So that's why I don't think this provides good information. Like Martin pointed out, when you have a global operation, you are segregating local payment and headquarters payment, and aggregating all numbers as a cash in the consolidated financial statement do not really provide realistic information. And starting from cash flow statement would mislead users. That's the first reason. And second reason is cost and benefit. And I disagree with the analysis you made. We shouldn't underestimate the cost a preparer has to bear. And starting from cash flow causes lots of unnecessary work. Because you know the definition of financial activity is vague. Say, for example, interest payment is in the operating activities. So then you have to come back to the what the interest payment is all about. And in order to make everything clear, it takes a lot of time, and it may require a system change. And then if you look at the current environment of IFRS, we are going to launch revenue in 2018 and also IFRS 9. And also we are going to launch lease, IFRS 16. It all relates to the this cash flow statement. And then you are saying that effective date is 1st of 2017, then you have to prepare for the based on the current standard, and then 1 year later you have to cope with IFRS 9 and IFRS 15, and then all of a sudden in 2019, which we decided today, you have to cope with lease standard, and in the case of lease, it brings a lots of tension to this reconciliation, because basically all of the lease would be financial activity, but you know some of the activity goes to the operating activity,
and bring it then back to the financial and make it reconciliation gives a lot of work. And it's going to be a big change from the first one and the second one. So they have to change it. Moreover, what we are discussing about cash flow statement is we believe today's cash flow statement is not perfect. So we have to address it in the future in the project of performance reporting or whatever. I don't know what time frame is all about. So it's really it's really pity to ask something based on something we don't think perfect. So that's the second reason. And third would be the more like suggestion. As you are now providing the objective of this project, and we discussed what's the constraint of cash and the interaction between cash and liquidity, and we need to address it anyway. So if that is the case, I think we should give up coupling with IS7. We don't have to be obsessed with IS7. We just decouple from the IS7, and rather we concentrate on liquidity issue and allow the preparer to explain it. That would provide much better information to the users rather than coupling to the IS7. So that's the three reasons. With three reasons, I disagree with number 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, ask a question. So Taka, among your reasons, you mentioned the effective date, but we didn't vote yet the effective date, right?
We didn't
voted yet the effective date. So are you actually suggesting that we should reconsider?
No, it's impossible.
It's not going to my opinion.
Yeah. Okay, so even if we change for 18, you keep for the other two reasons. Okay.
And I'm just a signal. I'm also contemplating a dissent here. Last month when the question was asked, do I support the reconciliation, I didn't vote for it. And it was largely around the rationale that Tak provided for question one or point one, which is the incompleteness and the potential, I think, for delivering a misleading picture in the financial statements about a company's net debt position. If we're going to do something right, let's do it right. If we're going to make an improvement, let's not do it incomplete. And that's my major concern here. I'll give thought to what Tak has written, and also look at the relative balance of what improvements, in fact, will come through here. I'm not completely convinced that it really is in the eye of the beholder and how faithful the CFO wants to make this picture. If they want to do it right, then there won't be a problem. But if they want to be cute and look at the letter of what the requirement says, I think there's a danger it will be misleading. And my biggest problem right now is the point that Martin and others have made, which is if I've got debt at a holding company and I've got cash spread around the world, and if I'm purporting to use in a net debt reconciliation that cash available to reduce that debt, when in fact I haven't given tax effect to that, that in my mind is misleading.
But this isn't a net debt reconciliation.
Yeah.
I don't see how you can dissent to something which it isn't.
Well, I don't know what it's going to be called. This paper talks about a net debt reconciliation at the very beginning, 11B.
But the amendment isn't a net debt reconciliation.
The amendment is a reconciliation of liabilities that form part of the entity's financing activities.
I mean, all it does is provide a roll forward for something in the balance sheet where we currently don't have a roll forward.
Well, that's why I'm uncertain as to what it's actually going to say in the final words. Because if the basis for conclusion starts talking about net debt, as it did in the ED,
well, the basis of conclusion, that was a history about how the project arose,
and then it
quickly goes into why we decided to look at a gross reconciliation. But that is the only time I think we mentioned net debt, just in terms of history.
I don't think we're prohibiting someone from using that as a platform.
Nor do we do it at the moment.
To portray net debt as they define.
There isn't a standard either, Philippe, right now.
I have signaled last month that I might also dissent. I've been thinking about it. I've been talking to the staff. I would have preferred, and I voted against decoupling, to look at the broad picture and to provide only one set of improvements to IS7 instead of having a timetable of three successive amendments, right? One about the conciliation, one about the cash disincentives, and further then a full rethinking of IS7. To me, this goes against a stable platform and a proper management of our project. This being said, I think that the reconciliation is a marginal improvement to the current situation, so I will not vote against it.
Yeah. What I was going to say is, you know, not every project we do is a major project. Once it's not that, it's a narrow project. Whether a narrow amendment, improvement, or a very surgical standard, in which tells me the world moves and improves in small steps sometimes. And I think this is, you know, maybe not a small step, it's not a giant leap for mankind either, but it's a nice improvement. I think we should go ahead and do it.
Okay. All right. Permission to ballot.
Effective. Yeah. 13 in favor.
The sense we have heard. Then the effective date. And we could ask the staff to react a bit to what Tak said about that. No,
yes.
In relation with other parts of the government.
So you voted this morning, I guess, for the 2019 for leases. And this effective date for the reconciliation is 17. On the 2019, we expect that this reconciliation will present different pictures, but that will be an effect of the leases standard. It will not be an effect of the reconciliation, because some leases that are not in the balance sheet on the year 19 will come in the balance sheet and also will come in into the reconciliation. So I don't know what are the transitional provisions of leases standards now, but I got the sense that the balance sheet will look different anyway already, right? So that's why we don't think it's a problem if we have the 17 year for the reconciliation, because it will make all those financial statements different and the reconciliation could not be different.
Could you remind us whether it is prospective or retrospective? What about presenting the reconciliation for the previous year? Because if we say 1117 with retrospective application, it means that 116 has to be restated or presented. And this is very short because it's just tomorrow and people may not have the systems in place. So I think the effective date should be coupled with the transition requirements. So can you remind us what you have in mind?
It will be retrospective, so we'll require comparatives. That's the way it's
Yeah, but then I think it has a serious impact on the timing of the effective date, because I don't think that many companies can really be prepared to publish this reconciliation from just 2 months ahead.
Which would plead for 2018.
Not mandate comparisons.
Yeah.
One of those two.
Well, is there a...
Okay, can we see...
I have sympathy for 2018 as well, and especially consider the proposed timetable. So they issue final amendments planned for December 2015. So if we do have the final amendment in December 2015, we are thinking we'll face the problem that Philippe is already, if we have the final amendment published. So I think to 2018 is more appropriate.
Mary?
I support 2017. I think the point that Philippe raised about comparatives is a good one. If we think that requires more time, I think I'd rather drop the comparative than push back the mandatory effective date. And I think if we were going to push out the effective date to 2018, then I would say let's revisit the decisions we just made about whether or not we can get the work done on the other project. I think the gross reconciliation of debt is something for which a two-year gap between publication and, you know, mandatory effective date is appropriate, subject to, you know, to the comparatives issue. If we're going to push it out further, then see if we can pull up the other piece.
So if we amend the proposal to no.
It's the same as Mary. I would agree we should do it 2070, but then really forget the comparatives, because I think the information value of that is also limited. And so this better reconciliation of the current year is what it is about, and not who's interested in the past year reconciliation.
Okay, can we agree with dropping the comparatives and then go for 2017?
Yes.
13 in favor.
Okay. So with that, have we also answered five?
Yes.
Proposed timetable.
Permission to ballot.
Yep.
13.
Okay.